think it'll be unanimous, but I...
Good.
Call the House Committee on Health Care to order.
Your folks.
For this lovely February 3rd of the year 2017, and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2015. Madam Minister, what do we have here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2015 comes to the committee at the request of Speaker Kotak. It directs the Oregon Health Authority to reimburse doulas at a rate of no less than $350 per pregnancy for services provided to medical assistant recipients. Mr. Chair, can we bring the other folks, Madam Speaker?
Call the first panel.
Shafia Monroe and Ryan Fisher.
While the panel's coming, let me make two announcements. We are carrying over, or we are rescheduling House Bill 2517 and House Bill 3135 for 2527 for probably next Monday. And we have permission to go an hour long on the next Wednesday and next Friday. So plan on a three-hour meeting next Wednesday and Friday. Also plan on being here, and we need to have quorums to deal with the work sessions we have scheduled.
So,
Madam Speaker,
Wednesday night.
Please introduce yourself.
I wasn't moving on Wednesday night. Okay.
You want to clarify that for Wednesday?
Just the exact dates. What's next?
You mean the 5th and the 7th, or the next Wednesday?
No, next Wednesday and
12th.
Next Friday.
12th and the 14th.
Okay.
Oh, 12th and 14th. Not next Wednesday.
Next Wednesday. Next Wednesday.
Well, we're just adding an hour to the end.
Friday.
So until
so not this
three to six.
Friday, but the following.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland, and Speaker of the House, thank you for the opportunity to be here today to talk about House Bill 2015. I have submitted testimony. I also want to call your attention to testimony submitted by Ellen Tilden from OHSU. So this bill has been 6 years in the making, and I have to be very honest, I'm a little disappointed that we have to have a bill to do this, but we do. So if you remember back in 2011, we had a bill that said, let's look at how doulas help improve birth outcomes. And from my perspective, help us as a state improve our birth outcomes from women of color. Half of our deliveries in Medicaid, half of the babies delivered in the state are on Medicaid. So anything we can do to improve the birth outcomes through our Medicaid program is where we start. But the studies have shown, even in private pay, women of color in the state have lower birth outcomes than the rest of the population, and we need to fix that. We know that doulas are one way to do that, an evidence-based practice, not only in delivery, but in prenatal and postpartum care that will improve outcomes for women and their children. And the fact that we have not moved forward in the state on this issue is appalling. And one would even argue, and you might see this in testimony, if this were some drug that we knew was as efficacious, it would be malpractice that we have not done a better job providing access to doulas.
For a drug, it wouldn't be that cheap.
It wouldn't be that cheap, would it, Mr. Chair? Here's the challenge. This bill wants to put a fee for a particular service in statute. That is not the ideal way to do this. But I am frankly tired of having conversations with the Oregon Health Authority of how to do this. We pointed out to them several years ago that $75 per delivery was unbelievably low. We started a conversation of how to improve that. And I feel like we have just not made progress. So what you see in this bill with the Dash 2 amendments is to make sure we can get a set price, a bundled package, not only including delivery, but a certain number of visits and some money for a backup doula. If for some reason, you know, the doula has multiple clients and can't be there. This is good practice. We're going to improve our birth outcomes if we do this. And we will also solve the other issue is, until we resolve this, how we pay for doulas, we have the challenge of actually building the workforce we need to be there. When we passed coordinated care organizations, we said we needed more traditional health workers like doulas to help improve our birth outcomes. But we've had a workforce issue, primarily because we don't know why people would go into this when we're not paying them anything to do it. So this is a way of saying let's pay folks at least at some rate that we know is defensible and will help us move us toward better service and a workforce that we need. The other thing in the Dash 2, it requires our CCOs to actually tell the pregnant women that it is a service that is available and paid for. I think our study of all the works, all the websites didn't frankly show that anywhere, even though it's been a allowable and required service for a while. So this is a bill a little out of frustration, but ultimately what it's about is improving birth outcomes for our women in the Medicaid program, particularly women of color. And we know the numbers are bad, and we need to fix them, and this is one way to go about doing it. So with that, I think I'll stop and allow the other experts to tell you what they think. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Are there any questions of the speaker?
I do.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Madam Speaker, for bringing this forward. Just curious, for one, I don't think $350 is enough, but that's just me because, you know, I'm one that had 29 hours of labor with my first and 27 with my second.
Third.
I've seen how the learning curve was. So.
Just curious if this is indexed at all, or are we just saying it's going to be, I mean, it's a pity that you had to put it in there, but does the amendment index it? Does it have it? Will it increase over time, given, or is it just that, and then we got to come back?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Peck. Good questions. I forgot to mention that in the Dash 2, there would set in place a requirement of the Traditional Health Worker Commission to review this on a regular basis and reset, you know, regarding increased costs and things like that. So we have a mechanism for increases over time. And also, you know, I will leave this up to the committee. We started off at I can go into the calculation of how we got to this becomes a 400 and, what's the total here, 425 package. But research is showing we should probably go up to nearly $1,000 to make this actually work and be most cost effective. If you'd like to do that, we can look at the research and change the number.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. Introduce yourself.
Good afternoon, Chair and distinguished ladies and gentlemen. My name is Shafia Monroe, and I'm here to testify. I feel as an expert. I have been working with maternal and child health for over 40 years. I have a master's in public health. I'm a veteran midwife. I'm a mother of 7, grandmother of 9. I travel the world internationally to look at health disparities around infant mortality. And so Oregon, though it's better than some parts of the country, it still has a health disparity when it comes to women of color having their babies in a healthy way. According to Kaiser Foundation 2015, you may know this, but out of the statistics, 4 babies out of 1,000 who are Caucasian will die before age 1, which is tragic. But also, comparatively, there will be 8 babies out of 1,000 who are African American will not live to be their first birth. See their first birthday. So by having doulas available, I'm sure you've heard the statistics, we can make a better outcome in how this happens. I'm here because I've been involved with HB 3311 when we look at the study, and I was here again celebrating what I thought was a success with HB 3650. We then promised the Medicaid clients that you could have access to a doula, that this is not something just for middle class and wealthy women. You're also worthy of this service. Well, it hasn't happened. I've gotten calls from every single hospital over the last 5 years saying, my organization, ICTC, we have women here on Medicaid. Can you please send us a doula who's culturally specific? And unfortunately, we could not create that industry because there are no doulas of color who can afford to do the work for only $75. And if they did want to do it, the Oregon Health Authority has not been successful in even paying them. So we have women now who did do the work on good faith a year ago who have not yet gotten paid. And so looking at HB 2015 and Dash 2 is a perfect way that I want to support us to move forward because women on Medicaid have the right also to access what you and I can access around having a healthy birth experience. The other issue is that I have women who are on Medicaid. They have them with a doula. They're so excited. Oh, my God, I loved having a doula. She was awesome. I want to be a doula. I want to go back and serve my community. Great, let's do that. They come back. I don't have $800 to pay for a doula training or $400. They can't even access the training. And then for the few that we can get scholarships for, which we've been successful, who take the training, they do the work, but by the third birth, they're missing an action. We call up what's going on. I can't keep doing births for free. I have to go get a regular job. So though we're trying to diversify the workforce, there's nothing place to do that. So this bill is really an imperative for us to go forth on what we promised our constituents, the women I serve, almost 3 or 5 years ago. The other piece is that I've been asking the OHA and the CCOs for quite some time, How do we let Medicaid clients know that it's their legal right to access a doula? There's no way. We just found out what the word is. It's Greek. Who knows what a doula is? We're still trying to figure it out. I might know. I'm a health professional. But the average person does not know. The power in having a CCO put it on their website and put it in their packet and put it for the intake work is going to let the Medicaid person feel safe that this is a good thing that's going to help them. We want to save the work of babies being born too small and too sick. And the women that I see, they are losing their babies. They're burying their babies. Their babies are being born at 27 weeks gestation, you know, two-pound baby. We're talking about long-term learning problems. As a state, we're committed to creating citizens who can enter school ready to learn, be viable citizens, add to the workforce. Without passing HB 2015 and the Dash 2, we're not going to meet our mandate for that. So basically, I'm optimistic in the everyone sitting here that we're going to make sure that women on Medicaid get the promise, the fulfillment of what we promised them back with HB 365, that they could actually have a doula at their birth. They're calling us. We saw it. We had over 60 calls last year. I know I have 3 minutes. I have no idea what time it is right now. But
we need
this to happen, you guys. It's taken too long, and to be honest, it's embarrassing, because I promised them as a leader in my community that you can get a doula from your community, whether Hispanic, Muslim, African-American, gay, lesbian, although we need every single venue to be full. And so there's a huge gap to fill the industry. So I'm going to end with that.
Thank
Any
you
questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. Members of the committee, my name is Ryan Fisher. I'm here today on behalf of Oregon Health and Science University in support of House Bill 2015. Dr. Thornburg, who is the director of the Moore Institute for Nutritional Flow at OHSU, and who is also has a professorial appointment in obstetrics and gynecology. Obviously, I do not have that credential because I can barely say it. He was disappointed he wasn't able to be here today. I think maybe you have seen him before, many of you in this committee, to talk about the developmental origins of health and disease and the critical impact that low stress, good nutrition, and consistent breastfeeding can have long term for the health outcomes of children. And so I want to draw your attention to the written testimony that is in OLIS that he submitted specifically on this bill. And just my part is to let you know that there is some really strong research that shows that this doesn't just impact those few weeks, well, it's more than weeks that a doula would work with a family, but really the lifetime of the child because of that, the critical impact that those factors have. So thank you very much for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick, and mostly for you, Mr. Fisher, but anybody could answer the question. We've been working in this committee. One of the things that I've been passionate about with some of my members here is working with the fact that the Oregon Health Authority has members on fee-for-service, about 16% now, or 150,000 members not assigned to a CCO. They go through a very arduous process to get re-enrolled or reassigned. One of the barriers that I've been presented with in my many discussions with the OHA is around this subject, that if they're assigned to a CCO, they couldn't get doula services paid for. And so it's been a reason that has been presented to me why some members choose to stay fee-for-service. If we move forward with making automatic re-enrollment directly into a CCO that they were assigned for before, unless the patient requests not to, would this bill help your clients or the people that you're trying to help, or would there be complications by not having them automatically rolled back into fee-for-service? You understand what I'm – we don't want to cause a barrier. We're trying to get – at least I'm trying to get more people into the coordinated care organization. I would like to push OHA to do that, but I don't want to cause a problem with your population that you're trying to advocate here for.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Hayden, let me make sure that I understand your question correctly, and then I'll probably have to go and get the answer and bring it back to you. But as I understand it, what you're asking is, would this bill require payment for folks that are on fee-for-service and therefore disincentivize them from joining a CCO?
No.
Okay.
If this bill went forward, would it make smoother the transition of getting members directly assigned back into the CCO that they were before? Would it remove the concern that some patients have, if they're going to have a baby, that they want to be on fee-for-service because they can't get reimbursement in a CCO?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Hayden, I now understand the question. I'm not able to answer it for you right now, but I'm happy to look into it and provide the answer to the full committee. Thank you.
Thank you.
The issue is, if this bill makes sure they're paid for within CCOs and in fee-for-service, then it should neutralize and worry about it.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Hayden, I think one of the things we've heard in conversations with CCOs is, well, we don't know if we'll get reimbursed or we don't know what to charge. Fee-for-service often sets the parameter for reimbursement in the CCOs. This bill will make it clear what a bundle package should look like. It'll be clear what the price is, and it should be very clear to the CCOs that they should be providing it and reimbursing their providers at that rate.
Any other questions?
Yeah. Bueller.
Representative Bueller.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. I'm curious what the Health Evidence Review Commission said about the use of doulas with regards to delivering these services.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Bueller, I have seen that some work was done on that. I don't have that information with me right now, but again, I'd be happy to look into that and provide what I've seen.
May I follow up?
Yeah.
Because we have a long-established practice here of when we add new services that the Health Evidence Review Commission looks at it, and, you know, you can usually, and most of these issues, put up expert testimony and evidence on both sides, and that's why we formed the commission to compare and come up with a consensus statement taking in the needs of the community. I'm just curious why that hasn't been done in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bueller, we can get back to you on whether or not the Health Evidence Review Commission has actually looked at the evidence behind. I don't believe they've done any review of the effectiveness of traditional health workers in our system, although that is a service that was implied and embedded not only in the CCO legislation, but also in the work that was done specifically at doulas as being a service that we would want covered. Whether or not the evidence has been reviewed, I don't think it's universal that everything that OHA pays for has actually gone through the HERC.
Thank you very much. Alan, will you call the next panel, please?
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you. Deborah Caitlin, Alberto Moreno, and Christine Larrison.
Is there one more pen? Please remember to introduce yourself.
I'll go ahead and start. My name is Deborah Catlin, and I am Dona International Birth Doula Trainer. I know a lot about the field. I'm here also representing the THW Commission Systems Integration Subcommittee, which I have been on for 3 years, and the Oregon Doula Association, which is a professional organization. They asked me to testify about what a doula does. So I'm going to have to talk fast and try to put what we do in a nutshell, and I'll start with that. But I also may have some responses to some of the other questions Representative Hayden asked.
Okay.
So a birth doula is a knowledgeable and skilled non-medical caregiver of childbearing families, trained to provide physical comfort, emotional support, evidence-based information, and advancement of client self-advocacy within a culturally responsive framework. Doulas collaborate with and are complementary to the other members of the healthcare team by focusing on the psychosocial aspects of healthcare. At the heart of doula care is the formation of a therapeutic relationship with clients founded on safety, trust, empowerment, and unconditional support. Parents are inspired to create a favorable health status and a pathway to healthy birth outcomes. This powerful dynamic suffuses all client encounters in the 25 to 35 hours average in the proven model, care model for families at risk. And that includes, we would prefer, 4 prenatal home visits at least, continuous labor and birth care, no matter how long it lasts, and 2 postpartum home visits. During the prenatal visits, the doula addresses culturally specific ways to enhance lifestyle practices known to promote optimal pregnancy health and well-being, identifies clients' needs for education-related services, and addressing any maternal mental health concerns, then points them to appropriate resources. Explains childbearing options known to improve health outcomes, uses techniques to reduce anxiety and stress, especially when these are associated with histories of abuse, trauma, or previous difficult birth. Works out a role with the partner and birth helpers that involves them at their preferred comfort level. Teaches parents strategies to be engaged in decision making about their care. Assists clients to formulate a flexible birth care plan as a communication tool with their care providers. And works out a postpartum plan for early parenting, breastfeeding help, and healthy recovery following childbirth. The doula also introduces a backup doula to the client in the event she is unable to attend the birth. During labor and birth, the doula provides continuous companionship, a calming presence, and high-quality emotional care through the entire experience. Is present with the clients beginning in early labor, helping them to stay calm, rested, hydrated, and nourished for the hard work ahead. Reviews signs of when to contact their doctor or midwife for advice on when to go to the birth location. Facilitates the physiological process of birth by suggesting coping strategies using coping measures and pain relief techniques and encouraging effective pushing efforts. Encourages the clients to voice their preferences regarding pain relief and other birth care options. Espouses client information gathering and shared decision making if needed, and helps the parents cope with a change in plans, including cesarean birth. Promotes immediate skin-to-skin contact between mother and baby, along with early and frequent breastfeeding to enhance bonding and infant health. Continues support through any post-birth problems or complications or NICU admission. In the postpartum visits, the doula gauges physical and emotional recovery of the mother and offers comfort measures, reviews warning signs for the mother and baby, refers to care providers as needed, offers breastfeeding support measures, and troubleshoots for problems necessitating professional help. Evaluates the family's adjustment, offers tips on self-care, and screens for possible signs of postpartum mood disorders that warrant referral for treatment. Debriefs and processes the birth experience with the parents and continually identifies client need for other services and pointing them to resources. And I hope you feel that's a big bang for the buck, and I hope you do consider raising that amount.
Wow. That's impressive. Yes, please.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. Good afternoon, and for the record, my name is Christine Larrison, and I'm the Program Executive for Women and Children's Services at Providence in Oregon. I'm here today to share our support for House Bill 2015. Providence hospitals are the birthplace of over 9,000 babies each year in Oregon, and we are proud to play a part in the start of so many new lives. And we know that the best outcome for those babies begin when they have access to coordinated care across the entire pregnancy continuum. In 2012, Providence launched the Pregnancy Care Package, designed to create a seamless experience for women from prenatal to labor to delivery, postpartum, and post-discharge. The package is family-centered, team-based model of care, which includes an essential role for doulas. In addition to certified nurse midwives, registered nurses, patient navigators, consulting obstetricians, and social workers. The care model in this package has produced excellent outcomes, including a lower cesarean section rate, lower rates of epidural use, and high patient satisfaction scores. Doulas play an integral role in this model of care. One grateful patient wrote to us, "The doulas and midwives and nursing staff are wonderful. I felt that my team advocated for me, ensured that I was comfortable as possible, and took excellent care of me and my husband and my family who are assisting in labor. I would highly recommend doulas to all women." Despite the important contribution that doulas make in the birthing process and the benefits received in improved outcomes as a result of team-based pregnancy care, a reimbursement from CCOs for doulas is about $75 per birth. This is far below the actual cost of providing these services. As a result, we within Providence are almost exclusively subsidizing doula professional services. The cost of 24-hour a day, 7 days a week, 365-day access to doulas for patients in the pregnancy care package is in excess of $500,000 per year. House Bill 2015 will begin to help retain access to doula services for the Medicaid population by establishing a floor in reimbursement. This is essential for patients who have access to these important services that help women through the birthing process and beyond. Providence strongly encourages the committee to support expanded access to doulas through improved reimbursement by passing this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Knows, and Hayden, and members of the committee, my name is Alberto Moreno, and I am here on behalf of the Oregon Health Equity Alliance today. The Oregon Health Equity Alliance has been representing the interests and concerns of communities of color, immigrants, and refugees whose population has grown to over 750,000 in our state of Oregon. Since our inception, OHEI has worked on legislation with our partners to ensure a culturally and linguistically competent workforce. We believe that doulas are a vital workforce in our state that meet the triple aim by lowering costs and ensuring support to women and families throughout the childbirth and postpartum period. Our communities are stronger when all babies get the best possible start in life, and doulas are a proven and tested workforce. House Bill 2015-2 is a step in the right direction to ensure that we are able to reach mothers and their families with vital support as they prepare to welcome new family members into their lives. The legislature has a long-standing commitment to doula integration as a vehicle for reducing maternal and child health disparities. And this has included House Bill 3311, as you heard, which commissioned a study on how doulas should be integrated into the Medicaid system. The outcome of this study recommended Oregon apply for a Medicaid waiver to allow for reimbursement of doula services. Then in 2013, I am proud to say that the Oregon Latino Health Coalition, my organization, helped to push and pass House Bill 3407, which established the Traditional Health Workers Commission, which strengthened the voice of traditional health workers, including doulas, by ensuring a standard for training and certification. Now is the time to continue our commitment to our communities and ensure that women are able to access resources to manage maternal stress. It's time to invest in truly ensuring healthier births for women and children. We can do this by setting reimbursement floors and beginning the steps to bolster a culturally specific workforce. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions in this panel? Representative Alonzo Leon.
Thank you, Chair. I have a question, and I'm hoping one of you can answer, or maybe somebody else with another level of expertise. But as I'm learning about the doula profession and understand how much value they bring into our communities, particularly communities of color, but can somebody give me a cost analysis of what it costs to have a baby in a hospital as opposed to having a baby at home with a doula?
I'd be
I'd be happy to address part of what you were asking. First of all, I think there is a misconception out there that doulas only work with a home birth population. Mm-hmm. That is not true. The majority work with the hospital population and some birth centers and some home birth. So I can't answer the first part of that question. I'm not sure it's been...
Also, doulas aren't midwives, then, I think.
No. We're not a medical care provider.
Yeah, I think a person who would need a midwife as well as a doula or something.
Yeah, they're completely two different things. So this is an adjunctive care piece as a doula to any birth setting, but most are in the hospital.
And this, if I can follow up, Chair, I'm just trying to help, I guess, illustrate the cost savings to having doula be part of the team as opposed to the general birth in the hospital, whether it's at home or not, and how valuable doulas are. Just trying to understand the cost around that.
There's been several new studies that have been come out and also declarations by several medical organizations around this. It's 3311 that did the review of several different kinds of programs that are out there. I have sent a lot of that information to Speaker Kotek's office, and I don't know if she can forward that to you, but that does a cost analysis, especially for the Medicaid population. Some of them are very specific to that, and that can give you a better breakdown. So I don't have that in my head.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Christine had something to add.
Well, I might add something. Representative Alonso Leon, the cost analysis, I think, you know, one of the things that we have struggled with is to pull apart doula services from really participation as an entire team, because it really is a team that provides the support. There is usually, at least in the hospital setting, there is a registered nurse and there is a midwife or obstetrician, a doula, sometimes social work. So it's very hard to extract the financial picture from the team versus the financial picture of what a doula might contribute. But what we do know is that when you put the right resources together in a team, we have been able to, at least on the inpatient acute care hospital setting, reduce the cost of care for that patient population that is already sort of low risk, identified in our care package. So they're low risk already, but their cost is about 11% less than other low risk patients who aren't in the same type of model when we've compared them. I don't know if that's helpful.
Okay.
Thank you. I was trained as a doula a long time ago, so I'm delighted to see the bill. But I first of all, I want to make a request that you submit the information that you had sent to Representative Kotek on OLIS. I think that'd be very helpful. The second thing I was going to ask is, it seems to me that the doula is the one person in particularly in a hospital setting that might be with the patient throughout. So the OBGYN might turn over, the nursing staff might turn over, but if you do have a long birth, as Representative Hack had twice, that is one of the values that they bring, is really that consistency. Now, a midwife would probably offer, at least on a home birth or a birthplace, that same kind of continuity of care. But I believe that's one of the things that's really critical for a doula. And sometimes, of course, there's the comfort that comes with that, but there's also a very valuable piece of information that gets transferred from a person who's been there throughout and can talk about the different transitions as other care personnel on that team might be switching out. So I just wanted to ask if that's true. Is my impression true that the doula is the one person that stays there throughout in a hospital setting? Home birth would be different.
Yes. Thank you, Representative Kennegeier. I will answer for a hospital setting. You know, our model is fairly new, several years old. One of the things that we had to do is move away from 24-hour shifts with our doulas to 12-hour shifts. And the unfortunate consequence of that is a change of personnel at the 12-hour mark. Mm. We're struggling with that, but labor laws being what they are and...
So to speak,
what they are, it was difficult. And so we did have to move away from 24-hour shifts. But we're looking at different models that we can sort of implement in the hospital setting for exactly that reason. The continuity is very important.
Representative Malmstrom?
Thank you, Chair. One of the things I'd like to add is a long-term maternity nurse, and have worked in labor delivery and childbirth education. One thing that it would be maybe good for you to speak to the group is about how many people get a lot of their education about the childbearing process by going to traditional childbirthing classes that are primarily aimed at middle-class white women. And so that gives them an advantage that these women don't have. So this is another thing that doulas can do, is prepare for the birth in a way that nobody else is going to be able to do, not only just because of language, but because of culture and detail. So you might want to expand a little about that, narrowing that discrimination in childbirth education as well.
May I comment to your question there? The model that the THW doulas are going to be using, they're going to be primarily independent contractors, so we will not be limited to those 12 hours that are common in a staff situation, and with an intrapartum care model. So this model that we've been proposing and trying to get implemented will be what you were saying, is the continuous care model throughout, from the time they begin in early labor, often with them at their home, and then they go to their birthplace with them and remain even up to 1 or 2 hours in the postpartum period. So I just wanted to make sure you understood that.
Anna, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much for your
story. Thank you.
I appreciate it. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2015. Before I open the next public hearing, I just want to, everybody's here, and I want to repeat what I said. On next Wednesday and next Friday, the 12th and the 14th, we'll plan on going an hour longer, so we'll have three-hour meetings if we need them. Those are the deadlines and working bills, and we want to make sure we have the ability to work at. Also, if you're not going to be here any of those days, we really need to have a conversation about that.
No, I'm not going to be here Friday.
Hmm?
I won't be here
next
Friday.
This next Friday. Friday.
Not the week from this. Yeah. Not yes. This week, but next week.
Right, 12th and 14th.
Okay. 12th and the 14th.
12th and the 14th. And as I said also, we're rescheduling 25, 27, and 31, 35 for next Monday, the work session. I'm going to open up two public hearings simultaneously. I'm going to open up House Bill 3090 and House Bill 3091, public hearing. Madam Minister, what have we got here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3090 comes to you at the request of Representative Kenny Geyer and Senator Frederick. It requires hospitals to apply discharge policy for the release of patients admitted to the hospital for a mental health treatment to the release of the patients from the emergency room department following a treatment for a behavioral health crisis. And I will let you explain 3091 since you're ready to go.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair, Vice Chairs, and Committee. I'm Alyssa Kenny-Geyer from House District 46, Southeast and Northeast Portland. And these two bills are kind of a follow-up on a couple of bills that we passed in 2015 with unanimous support from this committee, from the House, and from the Senate. The first one was House Bill 2948. We called it the Suzanne Gabe bill, and it was to really clarify HIPAA with an eye toward making sure that providers understood within the confines of HIPAA that they are really allowed, and in fact we wanted to encourage them to really involve family or chosen family or lay caregivers in the care after an acute acute behavioral health crisis. The second bill was House Bill 2023, which asked hospitals that had psychiatric beds who formally admitted mental health patients to come up with discharge policies that did several things. One was to encourage patients to sign an authorization to share information with a lay caregiver. Another was to make sure that there was an assessment of suicide risk as well as long-term needs. Then there was they needed to come up with a way to assess the need for community-based services and the capacity for self-care, and to come up with a process to coordinate the care in transition, and to make sure that there was an attempt at a 7-day follow-up. If continuity of care and appointment couldn't be done within 7 days, they needed to at least mark that in the chart, and the hope was that at some point we could go back and collect that kind of information, because if it's if they couldn't make a follow-up appointment within 7 days, then maybe it's just that we don't have enough community care available out there in the community. And so we had originally wanted this bill to apply to emergency rooms in all hospitals, but in the interest of trying to narrow it, we ended up choosing just the hospitals that formally admit patients and then and thus formally discharge patients. The Hospital and Healthcare Association did a fabulous job with that. We've come back and talked about that before in this committee since it was passed in 2015, and they came up with using the framework that we had, which also asked for to make sure that these policies were publicly available. They came up with a set of guidelines that the hospitals are now trying to put in place. So the first bill that you have before you, House Bill 3090, says, okay, now let's get to the second part of that, where we reach out to the hospitals that don't formally admit and thus don't have formal discharge, but they do release patients. It's often called discharge anyway. But this is out of emergency rooms, so it tends to be the smaller and more rural hospitals. And the one thing that we've added to this, besides asking them to go back and look at all those topics and try to come up with their discharge policies, the other thing that we added to it was a report back, because one of the things that we want to make sure, one of the things in trying to develop this bill was rural hospitals said, well, it's really hard for us to do this. It's hard for us to arrange for a 7-day appointment or to do the risk assessments or figure out long-term needs because we just don't have the capacity here. So the intention of this is to have them put into place what is the bare minimum level of care that you need when someone shows up in an emergency room with a healthcare crisis, but then what are the, we want to work with them. What are the problems that you have? What are the barriers you have in trying to make sure that they have a plan for continuity of care before they're released outside the emergency room? So that is House Bill 3090, and you will hear from a variety of stakeholders on that. The second bill is, and it's, it, by the way, it's complete gut and stuff, so just look at the -1 amendment for that. The second one is House Bill 3091, which is also a gut and stuff, so just look at the -1 on that. And this was an attempt at saying, what are the basic health, what is the basic parts of, essential health benefits that we need to make sure are paid, whether it's CCOs or private insurers. If we're going to say we should have parity, what is entailed in when one of the things that's necessary, and it's in our statutes on emergency rooms, it says medically necessary assessment. Okay, how does that translate in the behavioral health arena? We were trying, just like with the HIPAA bill, to take what are the federal guidelines, what are the federal mandates, and how do we kind of hone in on that and make sure that we kind of define what are some of the things that needs to be in that, and then ensure that those services are covered. Because one of the problems that we found is that insurers are covering at all different levels, and it's hard to build a workforce when you have a very uneven coverage. So one of the big differences between the -1 and the original bill is that in the original bill, we asked for a lot of things that we thought would be important, and then we had DCBS look at it, and they said some of the things that you're asking for are outside of what federal guidelines say is in parity. And we did not want to trigger, we've heard this often in this committee, how if you ask insurers to cover something that is not already called for in a federal mandate, then the state would be on the hook. And so we tried to narrow it into, in each of these different settings, what would parity look like so that it aligns with parity. So that's kind of an overview of what the bills are trying to do. We've had a stakeholder group that started working on the previous bills probably in 2012, I think, and then more and more adding on in 2013, and then in these particular bills over at least the last year and a half. Even, in fact, in 2015 session, they were already going ahead and starting and working on these. So with that, I'd like to leave it to some of the very many people who've been involved in this process.
Senator?
Hello there. I'm Senator Lou Frederick, District 22, North and Northeast Portland. Thank you, members of the committee and Chair, Mr. Chair. Actually, we started on some of these bills. I started on some of these bills in 2011 to try to get some of these ideas together. Let me just give you a scenario that I think is appropriate. About 2 weeks ago or so, I found myself at the Salem Hospital, the emergency room, dealing with what they thought was a heart condition. It turned out not to be, which is good news. But I spent a lot of time being poked and prodded and woken up every 2 hours to be find out whether I was asleep or not, which is a common thing in a hospital. They were very great. That was very good care. I cannot complain at all about it. But when I was released, with a stack of documents and a long list of what I needed to do. I needed to check with a cardiologist, I needed to talk with a nutritionist. These are the medications I should be taking. The suspicion was that the medication that I was taking was causing the problem, so this is what I was not supposed to be taking, and a number of other things. But I had a long list, a plan of care that came out of that. Now, I was admitted, and so that's one thing. But when you have folks who go into emergency rooms, especially for mental health care, they're not admitted necessarily. And unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you want to look at it, I have managed to be in, to take my wife and other folks to emergency rooms throughout the Portland area. In fact, I think I've been to every emergency room and every mental health unit in the Portland metropolitan area, including over to Vancouver once or twice, as I recall. She was admitted every 3 to 6 months for significant mental health issues. And she is she continues to work through those. And that's been since 1991. That tells you at least a little bit, because our initial work with one of the hospital groups, one of the medical care groups, considered that she only needed 10 visits to solve her mental health issues. That's not the case. And we need to make sure that we are actually being effective in this situation. So these two bills actually combine for me a concern that I've had for some time, how we are, in fact, releasing people with information to the people who are going to be able to help them, and whether that's going to be done effectively, and then understanding what the parity issue is truly about. I think I will be able to handle what goes on, what went on with me. I've got to lose some more weight, which is not an unusual thing, especially over here when you're not getting a lot of workout done. But I've got to lose some weight. I've got to look at my diet. I've got to take a look at exercise, etc. It's good for my wife and many of her colleagues who deal with issues in mental health field. They are working with this constantly. It's not a matter of a particular medication or one set of exercises. It is a daily and an hour, minute to minute situation for them. And we need to address that in a true mental health parity situation. This is one attempt to try to begin that process. I can't say anything more in terms of why we need to do that. I just think it seems to be a moral imperative if what we're going to try to make sure is that we have an effective, compassionate state. And that's what I think we should be having. Thank you.
Any questions in this panel?
Thank you, Chair. I just want to say thank you for bringing this forward. This is such a huge issue, and as much as it hurts my heart to think that this is where folks have to get treatment, it's better than nowhere. And so I just want to say thank you. I wish that there was a piece that we could add to this that said, before you leave, we're also going to connect you to a counselor.
We'll do that next.
I've been there with family, too, and it's heartbreaking when you walk out and you have nowhere to go. And you call your insurance company, and they give you two names, and you call them, and they say, we're booked, we can't help you. It's gut-wrenching. So I just want to say thanks for doing this, and I hope we do get there.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hack. And again, I just want to say the first part is what emergency rooms should do in order to ease that transition, those kinds of things. But then what we hear from them is, well, it's just really hard if it's not covered. So that's in the second one. I do want to say when you mentioned counseling that one of the things that came up in this stakeholder group that we've had is that there's a lot of emerging research, and we try not to be very prescriptive in this. It's more of a framework. But one of the things that happened since the 2015 session is we had passed a bill to start with a new position in youth suicide prevention, and there's an alliance around that, and I think you'll be hearing more about that. And we had a seven-day follow-up because that's the CCO metric, and we wanted to make sure that that was a goal that we had for everyone leaving, not just a CCO, everyone leaving emergency department. And then since this alliance has gotten together, they've really focused on, well, if someone has come in with an attempted suicide and there's real risk of suicide, really it should be 48 hours because the period at which the biggest concern is really the first 24 hours and then the next 24 hours. And so you can't wait 7 days in a situation like that. And then also lethal means counseling. And so you may hear from people here that we wish that had been in this as well. I think these bills will probably go through another amendment because these amendments just got released on Friday and just got uploaded to OLIS today. And so I know there are people who have little technical tweaks here and there, and there's some people that would love to see that in there. I want to at least say for the record that I hope that as hospitals put their discharge or their release policies into effect, that they were not holding them to this is all you do. If they have emerging research and another group that's really brought forward the best practices, that we hope that they'll be really looking at that too. We don't want to limit it to the bare bones that we put in the former House Bill 2023.
And if I may,
call the next panel. We have
if I may,
nine
Chair,
more witnesses to get to.
Really quick, if I may, I just want to say too that I commend our hospitals, and I know that they've been under such a burden to take care of this too. And I've visited some of those, and I've seen firsthand what that's like. And so I want to also say that anyway. Thank you.
I agree.
Thank you very much for bringing this. Can you call the next panel, please?
Julie Majors, Karen Meadows, and Chuck Martin.
I'm going to ask you all to be relatively brief.
Talk really fast. I'll talk really fast.
Don't talk fast, just talk short. Please introduce yourself when you begin.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, Vice Chairs, and esteemed members of the committee. My name is Julie Majors. I work as a family support specialist, navigator, and educator for families who have children living with mental health and emotional challenges. I serve on the Children's System Advisory Council and the Oregon Youth Suicide Prevention Alliance that Representative Kenny Geyer referenced for Oregon Health Authority. I'm a mother of two young adults, now ages 22 and 26. Many of you know our story, and in fact, some of you have met my daughter when she came and testified 2 years ago. I'm here to testify in support of House Bills 3090 and 3091, and to share not only my insights gained from navigating health services for my daughter when she was in desperate need of compassionate and skilled health care, but also my experiences working with stakeholders to craft legislation that may serve as a guide for all of us and stem the tide of us losing children and young adults to suicide. Looking back at the successes we had in 2015 in passing House Bills 2023 and 2948, I think we can embrace the power of collaboration to improve upon practices that leave people at elevated risk. The bills we're discussing today include pieces that were not successfully addressed 2 years ago. Since that session, I've had the privilege to fill a leadership role on Representative Kenny Geyer's mental health work group and to be a part of that group working in good faith to arrive at today's bills. It was 6 years ago this season that my daughter had by this time missed over 60 days of school, living in the despair of her depression, anxiety, suicidal ideation, and a long series of professionals who were not working well enough together to give her hope that her conditions were actually treatable and that life could get better for her. This left our family lost and scared, and it left her thinking suicide was the only answer to her pain. I can't point out one single thing that seemed broken in the system. As we all know, mental health conditions can be highly complex to treat, and our healthcare system can be highly complex to navigate. We have systemic barriers that I know we're in a continual process to improve, but we also have other barriers that are intrinsic to our being human. These include personal bias and varying beliefs about suicide and behavioral health, even among our most educated healthcare workers. Without the guidepost we're asking to be provided in law, we're not seeing uniform practices and responses to crisis across our state or even from hospital to hospital. I've been immersed in the OHA-funded emergency department pilot programs for the past 2 years, and I can attest to the lack of consistency that families face when their children are in crisis. Some are saying that statute is not the right place for some of what we're talking about, and that voluntary health practice improvements ought to be given a chance to develop. And as a former regulatory employee at DEQ, I agree that voluntary is often better. However, there are a couple of areas that I believe we need more uniform guidance. The parts of the testimony that Jerry Gabay and I made in fall of 2014 to you here that have not quite made it into consistent practice are based on research and ought to be considered a standard response to those in crisis seeking help from our healthcare system. Those include research-based assessments so that every hospital is meeting at least a basic standard of response, safety planning for individuals that involve their supports, be that family or other lay caregivers, counseling on lethal means, a 48-hour check-in to determine whether people have gotten connected successfully with their follow-up appointments, and reasonable assurances that services to help people who need assistance with coordinating their care will be readily provided and will be covered by their insurance. I also think that the educational information so we can learn about our conditions and the resources available to us that Senator Frederick mentioned are critically important. I hope all of you continue to support and to the extent that you're able to require the collaborative process being led by Representative Kenny Geyer until we arrive at agreeable language in the amendments for both bills without weakening the intent that we've all established for the most effective care we can provide in our state. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay. Chair and committee members and vice chair, my name is Karen Meadows. I'm a parent and author of a book on our journey through the mental health system. I also serve on OHA's Children's System Advisory Committee and on the Oregon Youth Suicide Alliance, and I am a board member of the Oregon chapter of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. I'm testifying here today as a parent in support of House Bill 3090. When my daughter was in ninth grade, she took herself to the emergency department on 3 separate occasions, each time saying something was very wrong. She was on a cocktail of psychiatric medications that were causing extreme disturbances in her head. Each time, she was turned away. Excuse me. The third time we were called to pick her up, ER staff told us that she was fine, that Sadie showing up into ER was getting to be a bad habit, and that we needed to stop her, not acknowledging that her mental anguish was real, and dismissing her judgment to seek help when she really needed it, put her at elevated risk. What would have helped Sadie and us, her parents, and is in this bill and should be in this bill, are an assessment of suicide risk and her assessment of her long-term needs, connecting her to peer support, community support, or other transitions, and a follow-up. Absent these things, our daughter further spiraled down and we had the worst possible outcome. Pardon me. Our daughter died by suicide several years later. I'm testifying in memory of my daughter and in hopes that hospitals taking the steps in this bill could have helped my daughter and will help others in the future, that this will help avoid future suicides, and I very much apologize.
Oh, no.
I didn't expect to do this.
No need to apologize.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
You're very brave to share your story with us, and we really appreciate it. These stories matter to us quite a bit.
Sorry.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
My name is Chuck Martin. I'm president of NAMI Oregon, but I'm not testifying in that capacity. I'm testifying as a family-to-family teacher, a class that teach us parents, siblings, and children of those in their family living with mental illness. And I wanted to bring you the story, with the permission of the parents, of one of the couples that's in my class right now. Young man, 24-year-old man named Keenan York. Keenan's mother and father came to our class 4 weeks ago. It was a class on problem solving, and they said their particular problem was, how are they going to keep Keenan alive? And they recounted a story that I wanted to recount to you. They found that Keenan had taken all his medications at once, 78 pills, in obviously a suicide attempt. They called 911. An ambulance came. It headed for Kaiser, was diverted to Legacy Mount Hood at 12 o'clock midnight. At 2 o'clock in the morning, the emergency room staff brought Keenan out and handed him to his parents and said, Keenan wants to go home now. The parents had no idea what they were supposed to do at that point. They did not know that Keenan was at greater risk at that minute than he was 12 hours before. And they asked the hospital if there was any mental health, if they had anybody with training in mental health, and the hospital said no, not at that time of the night. The hospital could not have transported him to Unity in Portland because Unity was not taking ambulance admissions at that time. So I think, from my opinion and my understanding of it, and my daughter suffers and has tried to commit suicide as well, I think that the emergency rooms are a silo unto themselves that specialize in physical problems more than mental illness problems. And I think they need to get a grip that when they turn people away and don't admit them, they need something. The staff needs to be able to give them some kind of counseling as to what the risk is. What should they do in the next 24 hours? What should they do in the next 7 days? Don't just turn them over to their parents and say, Keegan wants to go home. So remember Keegan York. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, panel.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming. Can you call the next panel, please?
Fred Campbell, Cheryl Ramirez, and Jeff Knapp.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. I want to begin by thanking Chair Greenlick and the committee for engaging in this obviously very important discussion. We are here in support of the Dash 1 amendments to both House Bill 3090 and House Bill 3091. And I wanted to thank Representative Kenny Geyer for her leadership and collaboration, not only on these bills, but on the issue as a whole. Every year, I should start by saying Oregon mental health system is in need of reform. It's unsustainable, does not always serve the patient's best interest. The mental health system needs to ensure patients get the right care at the right time and in the right place. Every year, Oregon hospital emergency departments provide frontline care to about 250,000 people who are in mental health crisis. Hospitals and their emergency departments are often the primary source of acute care services for people with mental illness and substance abuse issues, and we're legally obligated to provide stabilizing treatment for all who enter our emergency departments, including those with mental health crisis. But the goal of the emergency department is stabilization, not long-term treatment. And people with acute mental health conditions need a more appropriate, effective setting for treatment recovery. The Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3090 seeks a means of making sure those who come into emergency rooms are connected with those settings and supports so that they get the long-term help and support they need. And hospital emergency rooms have got to get that part right, which is one of the reasons why the work we've done so far and these two bills are necessary. Now, we've already been able to do some good work in this area. The association, in collaboration with our hospitals and NAMI, created and implemented the inpatient psychiatric discharge guidelines for patients hospitalized with mental health treatment. These guidelines incorporate requirements applicable to all lay caregivers, as well as clarifications regarding the disclosure of protected health information, as was mentioned earlier. And as a follow-up to the development and implementation of the inpatient psychiatric discharge guidelines, the OCA Association and its hospitals look forward to developing and implementing mental health release guidelines as charged in the Dash 1 amendments of House Bill 3090 for the Oregon Hospital Emergency Departments in collaboration with NAMI. I want to make a quick note, as was commented by Representative Kenny Geyer, there is a distinction between release and discharge. And the association would like to clarify that hospital emergency departments release patients while patients who have been admitted to a hospital are discharged. While these terms are often used synonymously, there are official rules, policies, and procedures that delineate those two terms, so we always try to be as precise as possible when using them. With that said, the association and its hospital members are ready and willing to develop and implement mental health guidelines for Oregon's hospital emergency departments. And we're up for the task of doing what is identified in both of these bills. In addition, we would ask the committee to consider mental health parity and look to improve and strengthen services for individuals outside of the hospital walls as we seek to make sure that we as hospitals connect them to those services when they come to us. Thank you.
Thank you, Craig.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, I'm Cheryl Ramirez. I'm the director of the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs, and I'm here on their behalf to support both House Bill 3090-1 and 3091-1. And I first want to thank Representative Kenny Geyer, Julie Majors, and other advocates for working so hard since 2015 to move the dial toward mental health parity. I really appreciate it. And you're working with a diverse group of stakeholders, many of whom don't always agree. So thank you. I just want to say a couple points on each of the bills. On 3090-1, we definitely support applying the same discharge or release, as you mentioned, policies for emergency department patients, whether they're actually in the admitted to the hospital or they're just in an emergency department and released after treatment. So we certainly support that. We also support the progress report on both the barriers and we hope successes in implementing the same discharge or release policies, whether a patient's in the hospital admitted or not. So we really like both of those aspects of the Dash 1. Secondly, on 3091-1, community mental health programs are usually the lead entities that provide these services that we're talking about in 3091-1, or they contract for them with contracted providers. These are most often delivered by qualified mental health professionals who are supervised by licensed clinicians. I'd like to point you to a really great written testimony by Dr. Ajit Jetmalani, and he explains very well with a great example of how this works currently. So given the differences in criteria for qualified behavioral health clinicians between the coordinated care organizations and the commercial insurance carrier coverage, we'd be really interested in seeing some sort of a progress update similar to the requirement in 3090-1, showing how if there are changes in the licensure status of the clinicians who are conducting assessments and in the number of assessments, care coordination, and case management services provided and reimbursed from the baseline at the start of the implementation of this bill. We really look forward to working with our health system partners and moving the dial forward and especially improving the access to behavioral health services by any Oregonian regardless of insurance status. And we hope both of these bills will both reduce suicide and improve health outcomes and quality of life for the people they serve. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chairs Knows and Hayden, and for the record, my name is Jeff Knapp, Government Relations Manager for Oregon for Pacific Source Health Plans. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to testify before you today and on House Bill 3091-1. Pacific Source is an independent, not-for-profit health plan based in Oregon. We serve commercial, Medicaid, and Medicare lives and are the contracted coordinated care organization in Central Oregon and the Columbia River Gorge. We are committed to ensuring to our members that they have high access to quality and affordable services and treatments. Pacific Source would like to commend Representative Kenny Geyer's leadership and advocacy for individuals encountering behavioral health challenges. The results of her efforts were very visible this past year, as the initial small group grew into a standing room only size group that consisted of a wide array of stakeholders. It was truly tremendous seeing the growth of this. We recognize and thank the many individuals who have worked tirelessly to build the many components of HB 3091-1, but we still have some concerns. We are particularly concerned with the language that would allow unlicensed providers to provide crisis assessments and diagnosis. We feel that this policy would place our members at an unnecessary risk. We understand that the healthcare system can be difficult to navigate, particularly for those struggling with behavioral health crises. Health plans, providers, and support systems must continue to seek ways to coordinate more effectively to address those system barriers. And toward that goal, we are engaged in a voluntary work group comprised of commercial insurers and community mental health professionals to explore how commercial members can benefit from the services currently unavailable to them. We are pleased to be working with the Oregon Health Leadership Council as it guides a work group focused on transitions of care, leveraging the Emergency Department Information Exchange, or EDI, and pre-managed tools. Although in the early stages, we are excited about the potential that this strategy holds. We have found great value in the conversations we've had to date, and it makes a lot of sense to continue the positive dialogues. We understand the sense of urgency around these issues, but we believe that there are many constructive approaches that don't necessitate legislation. Again, we commend Representative Kenny Geyer and the entire House Health Care Committee for your dedication to improvement of coordinated care throughout the state, and we commit to being a part of the solutions moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Can you call the next panel, please?
Representative Kenny.
Oh, is there another panel? Yeah.
One more panel.
I'll wait till then.
Dan Thoma, or Thoma, and Chris Bonna.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dan Thoma. I'm the manager of behavioral health with Moda Health Plan. I want to thank you again for the opportunity to testify on this bill, and I want to echo the sentiments that that others have expressed in terms of really praising the work that Representative Kenny Geyer has done in bringing together this very widely diverse group of stakeholders and driving relentlessly towards consensus, which has not always been easy, but I think we've gotten quite a bit closer. Moda Health does not have an official position for or in opposition to 3091-1, but we absolutely support the direction that this work group has been going in and are committed to continuing to work towards these goals of improving coordination of care for Oregonians who have presented at the emergency room for behavioral health crisis, as well as engaged in other levels of care for behavioral health crisis. As Mr. Knapp reported, Moda Health also has been working with a separate multi-stakeholder group to work on specific issues of how private commercial insurers and community mental health programs can work together to realize the goals of this work group. One issue that has come up related to this bill is the role of unlicensed staff in providing services, and Moda Health does believe that there is an appropriate role for unlicensed staff working within the context of a licensed and regulated clinical program to provide services. I've offered more specific recommendations in my written testimony, and I won't bore you with the details of that of those recommendations here. Again, just want to thank you for the opportunity to participate in this process.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Chris Bonneff. I'm here representing the Oregon State Chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, NAMI Oregon. We're a grassroots membership organization of people directly affected by mental illness and addictions. I'm here to speak in favor of the Dash 1 amendments for both pieces of legislation, 3090 and 3091. 3090 settled around, which is a common experience for those of us who have to avail ourselves of our crisis system by going to the emergency room, both as an individual living with mental illness and family members or support networks as someone living with mental illness, and that it's pretty consistent, regardless of where you go in the state, rural or urban, that emergency rooms do not have and apply in some predictable and systematic way an intervention for somebody presenting with a behavioral health crisis. It's not atypical to come in to having just attempted self-harm and the entire evaluation be, do you feel like killing yourself right now? No, good, you're ready to go. Rather than doing a battery of tests or the other types of evaluations that we would do if somebody presented with any medical issue. And so, as others have said, to us this is an issue of parity. This is an issue of pushing us towards standards of care that are consistent with the medical side. And so 3090 is about being able to collaborate, and we're very pleased that the Hospital Association has talked about collaborating again. That was a very productive process as we talked about discharges out of inpatient psychiatric care. We're very pleased to collaborate and come up with a common set of expectations and understandings that we can all use. In an ideal world, then our experience would be the same, but I want to share with you something I've been doing back there that is not going to come to conclusion until 5 p.m. today. I'm working with a family right now, being their loved one, their 32-year-old son, being discharged from inpatient psychiatric care right now, where the plan is not in place. Without
where the plan...
There is no discharge plan in place from inpatient psychiatric care. And it still happens, but because of the collaboration we had over this previous piece of legislation, we have the documentation that enables this family to go into this meeting that's happening at 5, armed with information that these are what should be in the elements of a quality discharge plan before you tell us to take our loved one home. That would not be the case without that collaboration. And so, as I said, in this legislation, it would be idealistic to think it's going to change practice overnight. But one of the real benefits is that backstops our experience. It gives us something as users of that system to go in with and armed and informed so that there is a collaboration in discharging a loved one. And in this case, a release from the emergency room rather than here's your loved one, go home. What do I do? We have a collaborative process where we can set these expectations in place and all be informed of them. 3091, real briefly, in our discussions over emergency room releases, one of the things the hospitals told us is one of the barriers in place to doing an assessment, doing any tests when presenting with a behavioral health crisis, is that insurers don't uniformly pay for that. It wasn't an expectation of our system. And so we have pushed very hard to make sure that there is clarity that this is a parity issue, that yes, in emergency rooms and also in other environments such as primary care where we're asking them to screen more and more, that when someone presents with an issue, there is clarity that an appropriate test, if medically necessary, is paid for. In addition, that there is clarity over that what that assessment says, that what is medically necessary to treat someone ongoing to get them from that crisis or to intervene if I screen positive in primary care, that yes, that should be covered and paid for, both by commercial insurance and coordinated care organizations. So to us, these bills go very much hand in hand to help continue us, our state in this health transformation that we seem to always be in the middle in, push it towards some parity and some standardization. Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much. Mr. Kinnaman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. This has been a hard hearing to sit through because I found myself reflecting back, I think it was 1989, if my memory is correct, when I voted in the Senate for the integration of physical health and mental health care. 1989.
I believe
in 2009 I voted with you for the parity of mental health and physical health in the House of Representatives. I guess I'm not a patient enough person. It's really hard not to swear and say something naughty. It's just amazing that we can continue this. And I guess what I find really disgusting is I guess we're going to try to legislate it a 64th of an inch at a time. And maybe that's better than nothing, and maybe just getting mad doesn't fix it. But, you know, evidently it doesn't really matter what the health care votes for and what the legislature concurs regarding, and the governor signs into law. It's been on the books for a long time. And I guess that's what I have to say. If I'm not careful, I'll even remonstrate on it. I just don't see. Maybe I miss it. Maybe we do have to go at it a piece at a time. But we ought to have some of these things enforced.
To add to the problem, we were hoping to get some clear insight into where the mental health system needs to go from the Oregon Health Authority. And what we have is a new mapping tool rather than some vision of where we need to be going.
Well, I'm
as frustrated
as you
are.
Don't have any confidence in that either.
Me too.
Questions?
Thank you.
Question.
Yes.
I've been holding my tongue also, but I can't do it any longer. Thanks for your work on this. It's so desperately needed. But there's been lots of references here this afternoon, including Mr. Campbell about, and just our chair also, about our behavioral health system. Can anyone tell me who's in charge of that system? Where is that system? Where do I contact it? How do I hold them accountable?
Well, we start with the Oregon Health Authority, who are pretending to be accountable for. Good luck. I'm going to close this hearing. In fact, both hearings. I'm going to close the hearing on 3090 and the hearing on 3091. Representative Kenny Geyer, where are we going from here on these?
I haven't had a chance to read the responses that came in about the 2-1s. I think there's some technical tweaks that people would like to see in it, and so we're going to try to do that and get it back to you so it can get passed out of this committee and hopefully passed by the House before the 18th. So if we are not, well, that's my hope. And if we can't get the tweaks exactly right, then I'll talk to you about whether it should go to rules for a little more time or to the Senate to work it out. I think we're very close. And I just wanted to respond to Representative Kenemer's question about parity. I think that the thing is, it's such a vague term. And so what we're really trying to do is say, okay, if it's parity, and if you go into the hospital and you need a medical assessment, then let's make sure that it's very clear that we need a medical assessment for a behavioral health assessment, and then let's make sure that it's covered by insurance, because there are some that do and some that don't. And by trying to really tie it to the physical medical side in the same statutes in the emergency room, if they do this on the physical side, they should do this on the mental health side. We're just trying to give more specificity to it and to define it without getting too prescriptive about how do you deliver medical care. That's the kind of sweet spot that we've been trying to find. We don't want to make it too prescriptive, but what is it that the community can really agree should at the bare minimum be covered if you come in with a mental health crisis and then you're released back into the community? So that's the trick, and I think there's, you know, since the amendment just came out, we're going to try to get the language just right. But
you know, it sort of reminds me of a story I heard one of my female legislators say that her daughter asked her, why are women seeking equal pay for men? Because everybody knows they work harder and do a better job. We're in this sort of situation here. I don't think we're looking for parity in mental health, because in some ways it's a more complicated problem than doing with most physical. We need better than parity. We need quality mental health care that serves the whole state, and we're a long way from it.
Mr. Chair, this probably should pass it up, but I just don't think one has to be a genius when you have someone suicidal in an emergency department. figure out that there has to be a plan before they leave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I mean,
but dealing with that patient is a tough issue, as you know. Okay, let's do some work here. First of all, an announcement. We need to carry over House Bill 2339. We didn't get the documents we need. We'll carry that over till Wednesday. I'm going to open a...
Can we recess for just one
minute? Oh, sure. Sure. Let's stand at ease. Call the committee back to order and open a work session on House Bill 2114.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I just want to remind you that this bill, we had a work session on the 29th. At that time, you adopted the Dash 6 amendments. We did not have the fiscal and revenue. This bill requires that an initial prescription for an opioid or opiate can only be for a 7-day supply. We adopted the Dash 6s, which directs the regulatory boards to provide notice to the licensees regulated
by... if I can comment, it doesn't demand anymore. The original bill demanded a maximum of 7 days of opioid prescription.
Correct.
This bill refers to a guideline established by a work group and requests that the regulatory boards endorse that guideline and enforce behavior to it, though. It no longer says, no longer gives specific requirements. It's now been supported by folks who were opposed to it in its earlier version, and I think there's probably no opposition to it in this form.
And the DASH was adopted with no objection, Mr. Chair, and we have a minimal fiscal impact and a no revenue impact on House Bill 2114.
And what's the DASH, which amendment are we?
We already adopted
the Dash 6 on the 29th of March.
Just voting on the bill.
Yes.
I had to recess, too.
Can I make a motion now?
Yes,
Okay. Mr. Chair, I would like to move that the committee send House Bill 2114 as amended with the Dash 6 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative moves we send House Bill 2114 to the floor as amended with the Dash 6 to the floor. The due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion?
Not seeing any.
Would you please call the roll?
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Aye.
Representative Buehler.
Yes.
Representative Alonzo Leon.
Aye.
Representative Kenner.
Aye.
Representative Malmstrom.
Aye.
Representative Hack.
Aye.
Vice Chair Nose.
Yes.
Vice Chair Hayden.
Aye.
Chair Greenwood.
Aye. The motion carries.
Your bill.
I'll carry it. Close the work.
Labor of love.
The work session on House Bill 2114, and open a work session on House Bill 2882. Madam Administrator, what do we have here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, 2882. We had a public hearing on March 8th. It's back before us with the Dash 4 amendments. This requires a CCO governing body to include a representative from at least one dental care organization that serves the members of that CCO. This has an emergency clause effective on passage. The Dash 4 specifies that individuals be nominated by the dental care organization and the representative is selected by the CCO. We have the fiscal, a minimal fiscal and a no revenue impact on the bill, Mr. Chair.
And I think, Representative Hayden, you want to comment on this bill? Have we reached the sweet point where everybody hates it?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Would
you like me to expand? You are a comment on
that. So the history of this, thank you, Chair Green, the history of this goes back quite a ways, and there was some confusion created, and not incorrectly, but the physical health of the CCOs was put into action so that they could figure that out. 2 years later, the dental health organizations, the DCOs, joined that effort, and there was some confusion about what a major health provider or major component of the health network was. There was testimony that that should include dental care organizations. It was ambiguous. So what we're doing now is a follow-up to a prior bill that said that the community advisory councils had to include a plan now that includes oral health in the plan for integration of physical, oral, and mental health. To follow up on that, this bill would put a dental care organization representative selected by the dental care organizations, nominated by the dental care organization, and selected by the CCOs. So neither side loved it, and so we think that it's the appropriate way to go.
Is there any other discussion on House Bill 2882?
That was a really good summary.
Did you call the roll? Oh, we have a motion.
Adopt the dash four first.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move that the committee adopt the dash four amendments dated March 27, 2017 to House Bill 2882.
Representative Nose moves the dash four amendments dated 3/27/17 to House Bill 2882. Any discussion on the motion?
Yes. No, I got a lot of help from her. Yeah, no discussion.
Just quick. I'm a dentist, conflict of interest provider for a dental care organization.
I think a conflict of interest that might end up making you more work is not really the same as one that may end up making you more money.
conflict. Let's hope the Oregonian can just figure out the difference.
Oh. Call the roll, please.
Is this on the amendment?
Yes.
Oh, on the amendment? Yeah. The amendment carries. No objection. Let's see the bill.
I like that.
Here's prerogative.
Here's prerogative.
Did you object?
No.
Okay, just checking.
Hearing no objection.
Here we go.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I'd like to make a motion that we adopt House Bill 2882 as amended and send to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Nose moves to adopt House Bill 2882 as amended with the dash four amendments and send it to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Could you call the roll, please?
Representative Henny Geyer.
Aye.
Representative Buehler.
Aye.
Representative
Alonzo Leon.
Aye.
Representative Kennemer.
Aye.
Representative
Malmstrom. Aye.
Representative
Pack.
Aye.
Vice Chair Nose.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hayden.
Aye.
Chair Greenman.
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Hayden, will you carry this one?
It's technically my bill.
It's your bill?
But Representative Hayden did all the work.
Well, you can have it if you want it.
Take it.
I'll take it.
Representative Nose will carry it. I want to comment just a moment on, before we close, on House Bill 2017, is that right?
The balance billing?
The balance billing.
2339.
Oh, geez. Are you sure?
Yeah.
Okay.
There are several amendments to the bill. I am going to recommend the dash five amendments. I understand Representative Buehler will want to enter the dash four for discussion, which is fine. Dash five comes across with a fine negotiation between me and my two vice chairs as to what the number should be. And it will recommend a payment model of 225% of Medicare. It was claimed I offered 250% and drew it back when it was accepted, but I think that's, you can't believe that.
Okay, for the record.
At any rate, there is no question everybody involved in this discussion wanted to make sure that the patients were taken care of. That was all of our interests. The main discussion was how much should insurance companies pay for these circumstances where a patient went to a situation believing they were in an in-network place and finding out there were physicians associated with the service that were not in-network. No, I don't. I'm going to close the discussion now. That was all I wanted to say. I wanted to give people a chance to look at what those amendments were so we can have a rational discussion around them on Wednesday. Okay, we've got a bunch of work to do between now. We have to have all our all our bills worked by the 17th. Is that right?
Posted. Right?
No, we have to have them done by the 17th. We have to have them
posted by Friday.
Posted by Friday and okay. Done by the 17th. So, please be prepared to do some work. We are adjourned.
I misunderstood.
5 o'clock. I'm sorry.
I thought you were adjourned.
I misunderstood. 5 o'clock. I'm sorry.
I thought you were